We will take Numbers chapter 20 tonight. And we come tonight to a rather important year in the history of the nation of Israel. In Numbers chapter 14, just about 2 years into the nation's history, they had come to Kadesh, which is near the border of the Promised Land. And they sent 12 spies to spy out the land of Canaan. Unfortunately, because of their faithlessness and rebellion, they were then sentenced to a 40-year death march in the desert. And they had, at that point, 37 years left, as of chapter 14, 37 years left in that death march, 40 years total. And we studied 37 of those 40 years between chapters 14 and 20. So just think about that for a moment. God gave us only 6 chapters to cover 37 years of history. And now we come to chapter 20, and Israel has done a lot of travel. But here we are, right back in Kadesh, same place they were in chapter 14, same location as 37 years prior. Where they were and where they could have waltzed right into the Promised Land had they just believed the Lord and trusted the Lord. But now, as we come to chapter 20, we are down to the final year in the history of the nation. If you don't understand my math, go back through and think through that real hard. We're down to that final year, that 40th year in the history of the nation. But where are we in the book of Numbers, and how many chapters do we have left? We have 17 chapters to go. 6 chapters to record 37 years of history. Now we're down to just 1 year left. And how many chapters does it take the Lord? 17 chapters. So to say that those 37 years were uneventful and insignificant is an understatement. To say that the final year is eventful and significant is an understatement. Numbers chapter 33 is actually a timeline overview of all of the nation of Israel, all of the history of their travel. Basically, we find out there in Numbers chapter 33 that Moses kept a really good journal. He recorded every stop they made, every camping location. Moses recorded it, and he gives it to us there in Numbers chapter 33. And down at verses 38 and 39, Moses tells us that on the first day of the 5th month of the 40th year, Aaron dies at 123 years of age. Now, chapter 20, our chapter of study for tonight, is going to tell us about both the death of Miriam and Aaron. Moses is actually going to survive the book of Numbers. And we're not going to read about his death until the very last chapter of Deuteronomy. That's chapter 34, verse 5. But all three of the siblings, Miriam, Aaron, and Moses, they all die in that final and 40th year in the history of the nation. Moses dies at 120 years old. Aaron, 123 years old, and Miriam, 127 years old. So that's what we're going to look at tonight. Let's begin in verse 1. And the people of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin, that is the southeast corner of the desert, in the first month. So as we start this story, we are in the beginning of that 40th year in the history of the nation. In the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh. Now again, that is the exact same location that God brought the children of Israel to in chapter 14. So this has been 37 years of history with very little to show for it. Very few positives to report, only 6 chapters to cover it all, and worse yet, they're right back where they've started. They've made absolutely no progress in 37 years. And that once again brings us back to the most important and overarching truth of the book of Numbers, and that is God cannot brag on his servants and inspire other people if God's servants give him nothing to brag about. God can't use your life story to inspire other people if you just get saved and then don't really follow him. If you're not progressing in spiritual life, if you're not maturing, if you're not growing, if you're not experiencing him, you are a total enigma. That is not supposed to happen. A lifetime relationship with God should leave behind an overabundance of testimony. You shouldn't have any short failure of items to speak about concerning your life and the witness that you've left behind. This is like, you know, being there when someone gets saved and then you don't see him for 37 years and you see him 37 years later, you bump into him at the store or whatever, and you find out that they are in the exact same spot with the Lord spiritually. There's been no fruit. There's been no daily walk with Christ. There's been nothing accomplished for Christ. No experience with God to really speak of. Worse yet, it's like those people that have been serving the Lord for 37 years, and you talk to them and they spend the first hour talking to you about all the bad stuff they did in their life before they got saved, and then they spend 5 seconds saying, oh yeah, and then I got saved, and I've been a Christian for 37 years, the end. You see a problem with that? I see a problem with that. The after of our testimonies should be the longest and juiciest part of our testimonies, not the before part. Sometimes I feel like testimony time is like a competition to see who is more sinful before they got saved. They spend all their time talking about that. Well, if you just look at how God adopts a testimony, you'll find that he spends way less time on sinfulness and lack of progress and spinning the wheels, and God spends all of his time focused on the stuff that can produce a testimony in the life of a person. So that's what we see here. If the book of Numbers says anything about the Christian, it says this: don't get saved and then get stuck there. Keep seeking, keep moving, keep learning, keep growing, keep experiencing him, because the Christian life is meant to be a dynamic, spirit-filled life. Reading on in verse 1. And Miriam died there in Kadesh and was buried there. And Miriam, I believe, leaves behind a very nice legacy. First of all, she helped save her brother Moses' life when he was a little baby. They were ordered by Egypt to throw all male-born Hebrews into the Nile River. Leftists have always been obsessed with murdering babies. Conservatives have always been obsessed with championing life. And there was a mandated full birth abortion back there from Egypt concerning the Jews. And Jochebed had a beautiful baby, Moses, and she just could not do that. She took a chance. She made an ark. You know the story. She made an ark. She put baby Moses in it. She floated him out there on the Nile River because then, you know, at least he was in the Lord's hands and he had a chance. And what I love about Miriam's story is that the scriptures tell us there in Exodus chapter 2 that Miriam was just kind of scoping everything out. She wanted to see what would happen. And about that time, Pharaoh's daughter shows up. And when Miriam finds out that Pharaoh's daughter has intended to keep this baby, Miriam is right there. And then she gets to pipe up and say, hey, would you like me to go get a Hebrew lady? A lady that was pregnant and is now nursing so that she can nurse the baby for you. And of course, she did. She agreed to that. And Miriam went and got who? Jochebed, her mother, the mother of that baby, Moses. So what a story there in Exodus chapter 2. And the best part of that is that the courts of Pharaoh paid Jochebed to raise that child, to nurse that child. So she was a mom, and she got paid to be the mom of her own kid. That's a wonderful story. We should have maybe talked about that on Mother's Day, but I digress. Later on, Miriam served as a prophetess for the nation of Israel, and it was Miriam who led the ladies there in reciting the Song of Moses on the other side of the Red Sea, having seen the Lord drown Israel's enemy. So she was a spiritual woman. She leaves behind a good testimony. She does have one black mark on her testimony, and that was her brief stint with opposition against her brother Moses' leadership, but the Lord forgave. The Lord reformed her. And I got to say this, hey, if you go 39 years and have only one black mark on your testimony, you are so far above average, you just don't even understand. That's not bad, you know, one black mark. Well, anyway, at the beginning of that 40th year, at 127 years of age, she passes away. So Moses here loses his big sister. So this would be a really good time for the congregants to be supportive and encouraging. This would be a really bad time for the congregants to start acting out and complaining and lacking faith, wouldn't it? Well, let's see how they do. Verse 2. Now there was no water for the congregation. Go figure. No water in the desert. Who'd have thunk it? There was no water, and they assembled themselves together against Moses and Aaron, because apparently it was Moses and Aaron's fault that there was no water in the desert. See how people act with their pastors sometimes? Their complaints don't even have to be logical. We are dying of thirst. There's no water in the desert. You know whose fault this is? Moses and Aaron. That's their fault. Verse 3, and the people quarreled with Moses and said, would that we had perished when our brothers, our family members, perished before the Lord. Verse 4, why have you brought the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness that we should die here, both we and our cattle? Verse 5, and why have you made us come up out of Egypt? Moses, you forced us to do this. We didn't want to do this. Why did you force us to do this, to bring us to this evil place? It is no place for grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink. Ay, ay, ay. Here we go again. We've heard all of this before, haven't we? Big difference this time, though. You know what it is? Look at the last part of verse 3. This is not the first generation. This is the second generation. The generation that the Lord has promised to take into the promised land. Most of them were born after the nation left Egypt. So they don't even know what Egypt is like. They've heard stories from mom and dad, but that's it. Some of them that were alive during that exodus from Egypt, they were so young that there's no possible way that they remember Egypt. Many of them too young to fully know the stresses and strains that first generation went through. But here we are, same place, same problem, same reaction to the problem, but disturbingly, it's a different generation of people altogether. So where do you suppose that this second generation learned to panic and complain like this? Where do you think they picked this up at? Mom and dad, aunt and uncle, older brother and older sister. This generation is only saying what they are saying because they have heard it from older family members for decades. These are what I would call chips off the old blockheads. Oh, Egypt was so perfect. Weren't there, don't remember it, but mom and dad said so. Egypt was so perfect. Life with the Lord is so miserable. The Lord doesn't care about us. We're back here with the same problems that our ancestors had, and all Moses and Aaron care about is that we show up for church with our offerings. This is just terrible. Life is awful, and then we're going to die. So I would like to remind us that parents should be very careful to guard their words around their children. I'm constantly catching myself with this one. And I would say to the older Christians in the church, I would say you need to guard your words when you're speaking around the younger Christians in the church. If you become jaded in church or jaded in your Christianity, the least thing you can do is watch your words around the younger ones, because you don't want to be the reason that the next generation struggles with basic faith in God or trust in the leaders that God has given. For this second generation, Israel 2.0, They are far too much like Israel 1.0. You would think that their history would lead them into confidence in a moment like this rather than complaining. But here we are again. Same old pickle. Oh, woe is us. Why pray when we can worry? Wouldn't it have been so much better if they leaned on their history to help them right now? How about stuff like this? Hey, we've been here before. Our fathers, our family members, they've been through this same stuff. We've heard the stories, and the Lord provided a miracle for them, and the Lord, as a people group, saved us. He brought us out. We didn't die. The Lord provided in that moment. Why can't the Lord do the same thing right now? He was faithful then. He'll be faithful now. No reason to complain. No reason to lose our cool. No reason to fight and blame the pastor. God is our God. So why worry when we can pray? All we have to do is ask the Lord. That would have been wonderful. They're actually in a very serious situation here. They're putting their entire future in jeopardy with their lack of faith. And they're complaining because what happened the last time that the nation was here in Kadesh, staging and prepped to enter into the promised land, here's what happened. They blew it through unbelief, through complaining, and through rebellion against the Lord. Israel 2.0 here, second generation Israel, stands to risk the exact same fate. If they're not careful, the Lord just might say, all right, fine, on to plan C. Second generation blew it too. Come back in another 40 years. We'll try this again at the same spot with the third generation. I don't think we realize how easy this could have gone from 40 to 80 years. We read about the 40 years of desert wanderings in the Word of God. We could be reading about the 80 years of desert wandering. But oh, the grace of God. Verse 6. Then Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. Here went the nation again, complaining and lacking faith. So here go Moses and Aaron again, doing what they do best, falling on their faces before the Lord. By now, I think they probably had those UFC noses and perhaps even cauliflower ear from falling on their face so much. It's beyond me why someone would want to put themselves through that and end up with UFC nose and cauliflower ear, but to each his own, I guess. I say, personally, if you're going to do that, if you're going to end up like that, at least do it the biblical way. At least do it the Moses and Aaron way, from falling on your face. Their body posture, of course, reveals the position of their hearts before the Lord. They are totally and completely at the end of themselves. They don't know what to do. They got a second batch of crybabies here. They have no idea how to proceed. And so they're on their faces in humility to seek the Lord. In verse 6, the Lord shows up, doesn't he? The glory of the Lord. The glory of the Lord appeared to them. And that's how it's supposed to work. Pray about your problems and God's glory shows up in your life. Seek the Lord and he'll be found. Ask the Lord for direction and he will communicate with you so long as you stick around long enough to listen. That's how it's supposed to work. Prayer should be black and white for us. We're going to pray, and the Lord is going to hear us, and the Lord is going to do something. Verse 7, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 8, take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and Aaron, your brother, and tell, underline that word perhaps, and tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water. So you shall bring water out of the rock for them and give drink to the congregation and their cattle. So, okay, that was easy. Big problem, but God's involved now, so simple solution. The Lord is not angry, so that's a good thing. He gives them a simple three-part plan. Moses, here's all you got to do. Part one, grab your staff. Step two, gather the people. Step three, speak to the rock. That's all you got to do. You can imagine Moses out there. This feels weird talking to a rock, but the Lord said to do it. So, rock. The people are very thirsty, so could you help a brother out, do what you're supposed to do, and provide some water. That's it. Three-step plan, easy-peasy plan. All Moses has got to do is get up there and do these three steps. So now it's Moses' turn to do that. And here he goes, verse 9. And Moses took the staff from before the Lord as he commanded him. Okay, he's got the staff. Step one, check. Verse 10. Then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. Okay, he has gathered the people. Step two, check. Step one, check. Step two, check. Time for step three. Here goes. Step three. And he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels." Oh boy. Where did that come from? That was not in the script. That was not step three. That was not part of the plan. Nowhere in verse 6 did the Lord say, "Moses, make sure you berate and browbeat the people really well." Nowhere did he say that. Maybe that's a word for some preachers out there who love to browbeat their congregations. You know what I'm talking about. There are preachers out there that equate browbeating to spirituality. If you're not berating the congregation, then you're not preaching biblically. That's really, truly how they believe. And I just got to say, if that's where a preacher stands, he ought to read this chapter very, very carefully, because the Lord doesn't like it when his ministers browbeat his congregants. Moses has once again, yes, once again, snapped. "Dagnabbit, you bunch of stupid heads. That's all as I can stands, because I can't stands no more." Moses is just absolutely losing it here. And you know what? This wasn't the first time that Moses snapped, was it? We've been reading about this quite a few times. Moses just snapping, fits of rage. And the kind of strange thing is that we know that Moses at this time was the meekest man on the face of the earth. We know that because Moses told us so there in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3, right? So here's the meekest man on the face of the earth. You know what meekness means, right? It doesn't mean weakness. It means strength under control. Meekness, just at its base level, means this: I'm in control of my temper. I'm in control of my strength. So here's Moses, this guy who is better than anyone at controlling his temper, and yet constantly, it seems to us, losing his temper. How did this whole thing start? Moses got mad and killed an Egyptian that was hassling a Hebrew. That sent him for 40 years on the run. He got mad and broke the first edition of the tablets of stone, and the Lord had to send him back up to get a second copy. He got mad in chapter 17 and said, "Lord, I am done with these people. I am done with these jerks. If you love me, if you really love me, just kill me now." And now in Numbers chapter 20, here's Moses flipping out on the nation of Israel again, berating them before striking the rock in a fit of rage. So what's with that? How can the meekest man on the face of the earth be losing his cool like this time and time again? Well, I think it's that we are uniquely vulnerable in the areas of our strengths because we leave those areas of our life unguarded. Just really stop and think about that for a moment. Our areas of weakness, we're very vigilant about those. We guard those areas of our life. We're actively working on those areas of life. We know their weaknesses, so we're trying to make them better. The areas of our life that we're not working on are our strengths, because we think, "Oh, I got this, man. I've got the temperament of Moses. I've got the patience of Job. I've got the determination of Noah. But I would say to that, be very careful. Because if the perfect storm comes along, you might be more vulnerable in your area of strength than anything else. So yes, it's a strength for Moses, but you have to remember this. He's been at this now for a long time. He is 120 years old. Maybe at 120, he's a little crankier than he used to be. He's made a lot of trips up and down the mountain. He's been traveling all around the desert. He's 120 years old, and he's been putting up with Israel's bickering and complaining for 40 years. On top of that, his big sister Miriam just died. I think what this is it's the perfect storm, and it caught him off guard, and even in his area of strength, he snaps. And he's not done. He goes on berating them in verse 10. Shall we, me and Aaron, bring forth water for you out of this rock? Will that stop you from sniveling then? In his anger here, Moses is actually taking credit for something that only God could do. Moses and Aaron cannot bring forth water from a rock. Aaron is 123 years old. Moses is 120 years old. They'd be lucky to squeeze water out of a sponge. They're not squeezing water or forcing water out of a rock. That is something only that Lord could do. That is God's stuff. So, I mean, at least say it correctly, right? Does the Lord have to bring forth water out of this rock for you so that you'll finally shut up and be content? Verse 11. And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock with his staff twice. At least he didn't start striking the people with his staff. I was kind of half expecting that, you know. So see, he is meek. He does have some control. He's not beating the people with the stick. He just, in a fit of rage, is beating the rock with the stick. And if you've ever lost your temper and took it out on an inanimate object, I think you understand why he hit it twice. I don't know what it is, men, but kicking that thing or punching that thing once just isn't good enough. It at least takes a couple, doesn't it? Or so I'm told by people who have trouble controlling their temper. So, strikes the rock with his staff twice, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank and their livestock. So what was the third step supposed to be? Not berate the people and strike the rock. The third step was to be simply this: Moses, speak to the rock. So let's watch the Lord sort all of this out. Verse 12. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron. You know what's happening here, right? Moses and Aaron. The Lord is taking them to the woodshed. Younger people might not understand what that means. The older people do. The Lord is taking Moses and Aaron to the woodshed. And he says to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe in me. So this was a deficiency of faith. Because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them. And we go, whoa, that is a very strong reaction from the Lord. I mean, very strong reaction. And we wonder, is that reaction, is that response from the Lord merited? Seems like kind of a minor thing to us. So the guy lost his cool. Big deal. But it's very apparent this was not a minor offense in the Lord's eyes. God saw this as a major offense. There are actually five different reasons why Moses is now disqualified to lead the nation of Israel into the promised land. First of all, Moses is the leader of the nation. So his mission is to convince the people to follow the Lord and trust the Lord. And that's something he didn't do here at all. The Lord mentions his unbelief. Moses here has deliberately disobeyed God. God told him exactly what to do, and Moses went off script. Secondly, Moses misrepresented the Lord to the people. Moses made it seem to the people as if the Lord was angry at them, and the Lord wasn't. He wasn't angry at the people at all. Moses was angry at them. God wasn't. Maybe you're wondering how that's possible. Well, I think it's just because for Moses, this is an accumulative thing. It's the same place, the same problem. This is accumulative effects of Moses kind of stringing the whole thing together. But to God, this second generation is like a blank slate. That first generation, yes, they saw the miracles. They saw the 10 plagues that miraculously God used to deliver them out of Egypt. They saw the parting of the water, miracle after miracle in the desert. And yet, when the smallest thing went wrong, they fell to pieces and lost their cool. This is the second group. This is the second generation. They did not see those things. If they saw any of the miracles in the desert, they were too young to fully appreciate that and understand that. So here's what I think Moses sees. He sees this. These people, time and again, just can't get it right. They're the same, every single one of them. But here's what the Lord sees. The Lord sees a blank slate and an opportunity here in Numbers 20 to do a miracle, to begin to shape their trust and their faith in him, to begin to really develop that relationship with this second generation. I think that's why Moses is mad. He's not making that disconnect, and I think that's why the Lord isn't. The Lord is making that disconnect. So he shoots off his mouth, and he gives the Lord a bad reputation in the eyes of this second group. Thirdly, Moses took credit for a miracle that only God could be credited with. Fourth, and this is the reason that most people miss, the fourth reason that Moses and Aaron are not going into the promised land is because Moses completely ruined, I mean completely ruined, one of the most important Old Testament typologies to date. The Lord was actually establishing here a very valuable typology to teach us about spiritual things, and that required for Moses to go by the plan, the simple three-step plan. And when Moses didn't do that, when he went off script, he completely ruined the typology. Let me read to you from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4. The Apostle Paul says this concerning the nation of Israel in the wilderness. All drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Now that is the Apostle Paul's way of saying that this rock that the nation of Israel drank from twice was meant to be a typology about Christ and teach us spiritual lessons. It was a physical prop that God intended to use to teach us about Christ. If you're wondering, yes, it is the exact same rock. They are in the exact same location. They called this place Meribah in chapter 17. It's Meribah in this chapter as well. It's the same rock that they are drinking from, and all of it was to represent Christ. Now, to fully understand this Old Testament type, you have to link these two events together. They were meant to be. Exodus chapter 17 and Numbers chapter 20. But now, thanks to the temper of Moses, what you have to do when you connect these two stories is you have to forget about what Moses did. He ruined the type. You have to go back in chapter 20 here to what God intended, the original plan. And you have to connect this with Exodus chapter 17, and when you do that, when you ignore what Moses did, you can still see the type as the Lord intended it. So here it is. The first time that the people complained about thirst was in Exodus chapter 17, verse 6. That was about 37 years earlier. And there God told Moses to strike the rock. Yes. The first time God said, strike the rock. It's the Hebrew word, tesur, and it means a boulder. The Lord said, strike the boulder. And once Moses struck the boulder, water flowed from the rock, and the people drank. Now, the second time the people complained about their thirst was here in Numbers chapter 20. Same spot, same rock. And again, forget about what Moses has just done and think about what Moses was supposed to do. What was he supposed to do this time? He was not supposed to strike the rock again. He was supposed to do that the first time and not the second time. The second time, Moses was told to speak to the rock. And this time, though it's the same rock, the Lord uses a different Hebrew word for rock. And it is the Hebrew word Selah, which means a high and lofty rock. Let me put that to you in more simple terms. This was an exalted rock because the Lord did a miracle with this rock back in Exodus chapter 17. So in Exodus chapter 17, before Moses struck it, it was just a rock. But come to Numbers chapter 20, when we see that same rock again, it's no longer just a boulder, just a rock. It is now an exalted rock because the Lord used it to provide miraculously and teach us a truth. So here is the prophecy through the type. Are you ready? If you missed everything else I said, just pick up on this and you're fine. Here's the prophecy about Christ through the typology. It's simply this: Jesus, our rock, would be struck, crucified, once and for all. And then after being struck, he would become the exalted rock that would pour forth living water to all who spiritually thirst. If you remember, Jesus said in John chapter 7, verses 37 and 38, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scriptures have said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. So Christ was crucified once for that purpose. And from that point forward, anyone that is thirsty for spiritual living water, how do they get it? They simply speak to the rock. They simply speak to Christ. Christ does not need to be crucified again and again every time we need refreshment. The type is to tell us this: he was crucified once and for all to provide water. And from that point forward, when we are dying of thirst spiritually, when we are spiritually parched, we can come to him and there's no need for another sacrifice. There's no need for going through hoops. All we have to do is ask the Lord and he will fill us. This is the point that Hebrews chapter 10, verses 10 through 14 seeks to make. I'll read through this real quickly. I'll leave out verse 13 for time's sake. Beginning of verse 11, by that will we have been sanctified, set apart, made holy, through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And every priest, this is looking back to the Old Testament system, every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifice, animal sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. Verse 14, for by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. That is a great verse there, that final verse. If you have ever struggled with that tension between the two concepts of positional perfect status before God and practical imperfection or practical sinfulness, then this is your verse. Just look at that verse very carefully. This is how it works. Christ's sacrifice for our sins has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. So you've been given a positionally perfect status, though you are admittedly practically imperfect on this earth. And the reason why is because you believe in Christ and have submitted yourself to the lifelong process of being sanctified. It's like taking out a car loan, isn't it? You get the car right now, Rachel. And one day, once you get all of the payments made, that car is then officially and legally yours. The bank no longer has a lien on it. And that's kind of the same way that it works with that perfect status that Christ gives us upon salvation. By faith, we come to him. Lord, forgive me of my sins. I turn from them. I'm walking with you now. And the Lord says, you're perfectly righteous for all time. Perfected for all time. That's how the Lord sees me. That's how the Lord, well, of course, that's how the Lord sees Maggie. She is perfect. But that's how the Lord sees us by faith. Is it true? Practically? I don't know about you. Not for me. I still fail. And yet the Lord sees me as perfect. How's that possible? That's like the car loan. I get the car now. One day it's going to be a reality because one day we're going to lay these fleshly bodies down. These are the things that drag us into sin. We're going to lay these fleshly bodies down. There will be no more sin in heaven. And then we'll be able to say, okay, Lord, what you gave us positionally all the way back on earth is now practically true. So I know that's a little off point, but back to our point. Christ was smitten once, and through God's foreknowledge, Jesus paid the price for all sin. Sin past, sin present, sin future, already paid for. All we have to do is ask him. He doesn't have to be crucified again when you sin. If you got saved and you've sinned again, you don't need the Lord to die on the cross again. I know this seems like silly stuff for us because we know these doctrines well, but this is not clear to everyone. There's some bizarre teaching even in the Catholic Church that talks about the continual or perpetual sacrifice of Jesus. Now, I know they'll argue with us that doesn't mean that Christ is still dying afresh on the cross, but if you really read their explanations, it sounds to me like they won't let Christ off the cross. He's still dying every week so that you can be forgiven. That's not true. That's not the case. Once for all, the body of Christ died to provide living water for us. And now it's just a matter of asking. So Moses destroyed everything that God was going for here. We're just lucky that we can see through the error and still see the type and the imagery that the Lord was meaning to depict for us. So those are four reasons why Moses and Aaron were not allowed to lead Israel into the promised land. But the truth is, even if Moses didn't make an error here and didn't commit any kind of sin and didn't do anything wrong, even if Moses did exactly step three as the Lord said, if you ask me, he's still not getting into the promised land. And that's because of reason number five. Reason number five why Moses is not going to be entering into the promised land is because this is yet again a very necessary typology that the Lord is establishing. Moses represents the law, and Jesus represents grace. Moses could not possibly lead the nation of Israel into the promised land because, folks, why? Because the law can't save. Abiding by the law, that cannot bring us into the promised land. Paul says the law can't save. All the law can do is condemn you. All it can do is point out errors in your life and say you messed up. That's all that the law can do. Now, it's beneficial for that purpose. But if you're expecting the law to save you, man, are you out in left field. The law is simply going to pronounce you to be guilty. It's not going to take you into the promised land. Only the grace of Christ can take you into the promised land. And that's where our next Christ-like figure, Joshua, is going to step up. And he is going to be the perfect type of Christ. He's going to be the type of grace, and it'll be Joshua that can lead the nation of Israel into the promised land. Now, if you're worried about Moses or you're feeling bad for him, that of all that he did right, he does this one thing wrong and the Lord shuts him out of the promised land. I just want to encourage you to relax, because when Jesus was transfigured before Peter, James, and John there in Matthew chapter 17, where were they? They were in Israel, the promised land. And who was it that came and talked with Jesus when he was transfigured? Elijah and Moses. See, the Lord snuck him in anyway. He didn't get to lead the nation of Israel into the promised land here in Numbers chapter 20, but the Lord snuck him in Matthew chapter 17. Verse 13. These are the waters of Meribah. Again, they were named that the first time they were here back in Exodus 17 at the first striking of the rock. Meribah means contention. Why did they name it contention? Because, reading on, this is where the people of Israel quarreled or contended with the Lord, and through them, he showed himself holy. So God was properly represented the first time, his reputation in place. He came across to the nation the way that he wanted to, but not the second time, because Moses ruined that. Moses portrayed the wrong reputation of the Lord before the people. Well, with that story at an end, we now move on to the next event. It is time for the nation of Israel to inch their way closer to the promised land. So let's take a look at that, beginning at verse 14. Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardships that we have met, verse 15. How our fathers went down to Egypt, and we lived in Egypt a long time. And the Egyptians dealt harshly with us and our fathers, verse 16. And when we cried to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. And here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your territory. This is something we've been talking about quite a bit recently, but the Edomites were descendants of Esau. Moses is a descendant of Esau's brother Jacob, right? You remember that? So they're family. And that's why he's appealing to the king of Edom as family. They really are family. Now, the Edomites, they are not Jews. They come from Esau, the carnal line. And the Jews come from Jacob, the spiritual line. But they are indeed family. And actually, it's true. If you go back far enough, we're all related. Think about that, husbands. You're actually related to your wife. How does that make you feel? Go back far enough, we're all related. We all go back to Adam and Eve at the very least. So technically, their family that goes back to Jacob and Esau. And Moses makes this request of Edom. He says, we've had a rough go of it. You know our history. You know what we've been through. But I don't want you to think we're weak. The Lord has been with us, so don't get any funny ideas. But, verse 17, please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or vineyard or drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or to the left until we have passed through your territory. Now, Edom is a very large territory, and it's right smack in their way between them and the promised land. So to go around it is going to involve quite a bunch of time and effort. That's a whole lot more food to try to get to a whole lot of people. That's a whole lot of water that you're going to need to make that trek. It's a whole lot of wandering again through the desert. And Moses wants to take the shortest route and the straightest shot and cut out all of that and just go straight through Edom and right into Canaan, the promised land. You can't blame him for that. And it's just smart. So why not ask, right? Couldn't hurt to ask. Moses asks, would you let us cut straight through your land? We won't deplete your land of resources. We won't stomp down your fields. We won't eat your crops. We won't drink your water. We won't even stop for takeout. We're just going to sail right through there as quick as we can, and we're going to leave no footprints. Verse 18, but Edom said to him, you shall not pass. Lord of the Rings fans can stop right there. The rest of us, we're going to read on. You shall not pass through, lest I come out with a sword against you. So I'd call that a solid no. You set one foot on our land, and we will slice you to pieces. You are dead meat. And Moses is thinking to himself, well, at least we got to know the neighbors a little bit. I think when we get to Canaan, we're going to want that privacy fence. And sure enough, these two are going to be perpetual enemies. Edom and Israel, they're going to constantly be bumping up against each other and engaged in open warfare throughout our studies. It goes all through the Old Testament. You'll see these two fighting it out. And then you're going to see even overlap into the New Testament. We come to the Herod family. This is what we've been studying in Acts on Sunday mornings. The Herod family was from what line? Esau. They're Edomites. They're called, what's it called? Idumean, as of that time in the first century, but they're Edomites is what they are. So even in the New Testament, you're still seeing that rub between the carnal line and the physical line. And what that is of course, yes, another Old Testament type that Esau represents the carnal life and Jacob, he represents the spiritual life. And there's always going to be that war. There's always going to be that rub between the flesh and the spirit. Verse 19, we got to hurry. And the people of Israel said to him, we will go up by the highway, so we'll stay on the main road. And if we drink of your water, I and my livestock, then I will pay for it. So they're just doubling down on the assurances that they've given. We're not going to take anything of yours, but even if we do, we're going to pay for it. Let me only pass through on foot, nothing more. Verse 20. But he said, you shall not pass through. No means no, Mo. And Edom came out against them with a large army and with a strong force. Verse 21, thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory. So Israel turned away from him, verse 22. And they journeyed from Kadesh, and the people of Israel, the whole congregation, came to Mount Hor. So simply put, they're given no choice here. They either go around Edom, or they engage in open warfare with Edom. So around they go. They're going the long way. Verse 23. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor, on the border of the land of Edom, verse 24, let Aaron be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land that I have given to the people of Israel, because you have rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. So yes, Aaron was a part of this. God holds Aaron responsible as well. Moses and Aaron both failed, and so neither one of them can remain in their leadership positions as the nation crosses into Canaan. That maintains the type. The law can't save us. The Old Testament system can't save us. Grace through Christ is going to save us. Numbers chapter 33 confirms everything we just read here and then adds to it. Aaron dies on Mount Hor on the first day of the fifth month of the 40th year. Aaron was 123 years old at the time of his death. So now, just 5 months into the 40th year, Moses has lost his big sister. Now he's lost his big brother. It's already been a tough year, and he's not even halfway through it. Verse 25, take Aaron and Eleazar, his son, and bring them up to Mount Hor. Verse 26, and strip Aaron of his garments and put them on Eleazar, his son, and Aaron shall be gathered to his people, that is, godly family that preceded him in death. It's a proof right there all the way back in Numbers of life after death. Aaron shall be gathered to his people and shall die there. Verse 27, Moses did as the Lord commanded, and they went up Mount Hor in the sight of the congregation. 28, and Moses stripped Aaron of his garments and put them on Eleazar, his son. What's happening here? There's a changing of the guard. The priests, they come from Aaron's line. Levitical workers, temple workers, they come from the Levites, but all priests come from Aaron's line, and high priests are going to be the very sons of Aaron. So this is Eleazar, the son of Aaron, taking over, the changing of the guard. He is now going to be the high priest of the nation. And Aaron died there on the top of the mountain. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain. Three go up, two go down. Aaron is buried up there on the mountaintop. I got to say, that's the way I want to go out. I don't want to die in the valley, struggling with my faith. I want to go out on the mountaintop, my faith just brilliant, as strong as it can be. He goes out on top, verse 29. And when all the congregation saw that Aaron had perished, all the house of Israel wept for Aaron 30 days. So here is one very noteworthy difference between the first generation and the second generation. The first generation wanted Aaron fired. And the second generation loved their high priest and are genuinely mourning his passing. And that's how it should be. Not you know, whew, the old pastor finally passed away. Now we can finally get a good pastor. But it should be genuine grief, because the guy who mediated between them and God, the guy who helped them to become stronger in their relationship with the Lord, was now taken by the Lord.